So hopefully I've turned on my recording. Looked like I had. See? Yeah, okay. So I've got my recording on. Share. Instructors sharing. Yeah. No, we're on the 10 page, the one without Neoplastic. Because originally it was heme and Neoplastic when it was done before, and Dr. Weston did the lovely handout for us. And so originally that's how we had it, all combined. She hated to do Neoplastic. I've done it before, so it kind of wound up or evolved so that I got Neoplastic back, and that's going to be one of the ones that's posted with end of life and cancers of Neoplastic. And that's one I've done before, and that's the recording that you're going to have to watch. And I think that's going to be put up there next week when we're out on Mardi Gras, y'all. Yeah. I know. Thank heavens for small mercies and all that kind of good stuff. So today we're talking about heme. You have your lovely little handout, and it's got some really good information in it, as usual. The chapter does jump around a lot, so we're going to start off with just heme. We're going to start off with the basics, so we're going to kind of go through, and hopefully I've got everything combined like it is on your handout, but everything's kind of put together. Because if you look at the chapter, it talks about this, and then it won't talk about the disorder till the end of the chapter. So it's kind of like all over the place, which I find kind of confusing. So the first thing when we talk about heme, of course, I don't know if I want to use this or not, are just the basics. And you know this. This is not anything. This is not anything brand new. This is not any rocket science kind of stuff. You know what all the basics in hematology do. You know about red blood cells. You know about platelets and thrombocytes and leukocytes and our white blood cells. So you know this. Am I going to ask you a question? Again, no. Am I going to ask you a question that says thrombocytes are responsible for blank? No, I'm not going to ask you that kind of question, but you need to know what their function is and what they do. So we'll think about that and kind of need it to know as we go forward. So hitting anemia first, that's page 1799. It's a condition in which the red blood cell concentration is lower than normal. Hemoglobin, you know, is that protein, and it's responsible for carrying oxygen, and you've heard that before. It reflects the presence of fewer than normal red blood cells, the hemoglobin concentration, or both in the circulation. So it's kind of giving us an idea of what's going on when we have a patient that's anemic. We see it sometimes in kids. We'll have kids that are anemic. We see it in adolescents. And we'll talk about a few of those reasons as well. It is the most common hematological condition. It's not really a disease, but a sign of something underlying. So people are anemic because something else is going on in their little bodies or their big bodies. But it's not really something all out and all by itself as far as a condition or a disease state. So there are three broad categories. We have loss of red blood cells, and that's from bleeding. So we're losing red blood cells, and that's from bleeding somewhere on their person. It can be a GI bleed. It can be a uterus bleed, uterine bleed, as far as with menorrhagia and some of those things. Excuse me, guys. It can be a nosebleed. Some people have persistent epistaxis and they have a lot of nosebleed, so it could be coming from that. It could be from a wound, or it can even be from a head injury. So we can lose blood or lose RBCs because of bleeding from any number of reasons. We can have a decreased production of RBCs. And that's referred to as hyperproliferative anemia. There is some deficiency in the cofactors, like iron, folic acid, B12. There might be bone marrow suppression. They might have a tumor. They might have be on meds. They might have ingested or come in contact with a toxin that can affect that. And there might be inadequate stimulation from chronic renal disease. So that results in a decreased production of RBCs. So the body's just not able to produce for any of those reasons. Or we can have excessive destruction or premature destruction of red blood cells. And that's usually with the hemolytic anemias that we see that happen. So it can happen then. An overactive RES, the reticuloendothelial system, which is a complex system of cells that's capable of phagocytosis. So we have all this stuff going on. The bone marrow produces abnormal red blood cells, and then they're destroyed by the RES, by the reticuloendothelial system. So, and we see that a lot. Well, we see that in our sickle cell anemia, and we're going to talk about sickle cell as a whole separate entity in just a minute, or maybe a little longer than that. So we have different types of anemia. It can be from a nutritional deficiency. We might have iron deficiency, folic acid deficiency, pernicious anemia. It could be from a toxin exposure, like lead poisoning. You could have aplastic anemia, which you usually get aplastic as an adverse reaction to medication, or it can be the congenital bone marrow failure, which is Fanconi anemia. Or you can have a hemolytic anemia, as we said, like sickle cell anemia or any of the thalassemias. So the major types of anemia, as I just said, iron deficiency anemia is the most common anemia in all age groups and the most common nutritional deficiency in kids. The lack of sufficient iron for hemoglobin synthesis. So why do we see that more in kids, do we think? Think about your iron-rich foods. Do kids a lot of times like iron-rich foods?
No.
Our green leafy vegetables, our organ meats. You tell liver to a child and a lot of children run the other way. Or anybody.
Any meat at all.
any organ meat in particular. But yeah, you know, people are not really into that. And a lot of times it's from nutritional. They're not getting it through their nutrition as far as they're not eating it or ingesting it. Then we also have those demands on the body as far as when they go through those rapid growth periods. They have a little bit need for more that they're not really making. Pregnancy, which we don't like to think about with kids and adolescents. Adolescents in particular, it can happen. And we know pregnancy puts another stress on the body as far as iron goes and iron consumptions. We need to think about our newborns. Our newborns are not eating solid foods. Usually they're not eating solid foods. Usually, or if you have any that are not eating food, have not switched over to food or whatever, usually at 6 months or so, they can get iron through their diet when we start adding those things, but not necessarily all the time. And then again, our adolescents that have heavy menstrual bleeding, their cycles are irregular, etc. So they can have a lot of things kind of going on cycle-wise that can really mess those females up and cause iron deficiency anemia. But a lot of times I think about diet kind of things, you know, as far as the foods kids like, and I can look at my own, my four-year-old grandson and the things that he likes and that he eats, as opposed to what you should eat and what he does eat are probably opposite ends of the spectrum. Lead poisoning, and we've heard of lead poisoning. Lead poisoning does still happen. Our kiddos in the clinic, we have them come in, and we always get a hemoglobin level, and we get a lead level when they're a year old, when they're 12 months old. So we're always checking that. We want to make sure that they have not come into contact with lead, which is a non-essential metal. It's not normal or natural to the body. And when it's present, there's a contamination of the internal milieu, which is a great big fancy way of saying that it's there when it's not supposed to be there, can cause a lot of problems. So where can kids get a hold of lead? Do we think about that? Where can they get a hold of lead? Paint on the walls. Old paint, old buildings, it might be lead paint. Yeah, or lead-based paint. And crazy as it sounds, yeah, kids do pick up those little paint chips and they'll put them in their mouth or they'll get it that way. We used to see a lot with like non-glazed or not glazed pottery, some Mexican or pottery from Mexico or whatever, just because of the paint that they used on that. And if you put food in it and the food was hot, there was something that was leaching the lead out of the pottery or the ceramic vessels or whatever. So kids can get a hold of it. We used to have a problem with mini blinds, the little mini blinds that we had, the plastic mini blinds. There was some lead component in that kids could, of course, get a hold of. And you think, you know, most normal situations, well, what are they doing? Chewing on the blinds? Maybe. There was a way for them to get a hold of it, and that was the source. So I don't ever put it past kiddos to do weird things, because they do. And to them, it's not weird. It's part of them exploring their environment and doing whatever. And they put things in their mouths. Even some of the little cars, my grandson loves the little matchbox cars and all those. So they had some little cars and whatever that came, I would say, from China or wherever. So they had some that came over from there and they were using lead paint on them or whatever. So you don't think about toys, but kids do put a bunch of stuff in their mouth that they're not supposed to put in their mouth, and they can come in contact with it that way. So we keep a check on that. We're watching for that, because lead poisoning can lead to cognitive issues, et cetera, et cetera. It's not really a good thing to happen. They can have vitamin B12 deficiency, and we don't think about that a lot. It's a cofactor enzyme in DNA synthesis. It can occur in atrophic gastritis, which I haven't seen many kids with that, pernicious anemia. Any surgery that removed part of the stomach or small intestine is going to affect their B12 or give them a B12 deficiency, including weight loss surgery. So you think about that more with big people than little people. Conditions that affect the small intestine, such as Crohn's disease, and yes, we have kids that have Crohn's disease, or celiac disease, or some bacterial or parasitic growth. Heavy drinking, hopefully none of our kids are doing that, but that can also lead to B12 deficiency. And then immune system disorders such as Graves or lupus, which we've talked about already. So those are all some things that can lead to or cause B12 deficiency. Folic acid deficiency. There's some deficient intake or absorption of folic acid. Can be caused by a lot of things, and you see them listed on your sheet. Alcoholism, malabsorption, pregnancy, lactation. Basically, everybody needs folic acid. We tell anybody that's thinking about getting pregnant to take folic acid because of the incidence of neural tube defects. And so we tell them to take folic acid. some of the nurses at the clinic were talking about the findings of taking folic acid and the relationship to coronavirus. So I hadn't heard about that, and they were also talking about vitamin D. But again, it's not going to hurt you if you take folic acid. Folic acid is good, and for some reason they have a deficient intake, or they're not absorbing the folic acid that they're taking in. So that's kind of a big deal. G6PD, glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase, is a normocytic anemia. It's an X-linked deficiency that causes red blood cells to be broken down faster. They're breaking down faster than the body's able to produce them. So we have a supply and demand issue. The body's making them, but the body's breaking it down even before they can get them all produced. Again, G6PD is most common in people of Mediterranean or African descent. And Dr. Weston, every time she did this lecture, she would always say fava beans, just like Hannibal Lecter, you know, he's like, I had that, whatever he ate, the liver or the brain or whatever, with some fava beans, whatever, so weird. But anyway, so she always says fava beans when she says something about G6PD deficiency. Okay. Factors that determine the severity of anemia. So we look at speed of development. Of course, more rapid will equal more severe, and there's less time for the body to compensate. That's common sense. So if it's rapidly developing, it's more severe because the body is trying to compensate and does not have the time or can't compensate. If we look at duration, is it an acute issue or is it a chronic issue? People can tolerate a gradual loss of 50%, a gradual loss of 50% before they become symptomatic. But if they rapidly lose 30% or more, they're going to go into, or they can go into shock. So again, chronic versus acute causing, you know, that rapid loss, they're more likely to go into shock. Chronic, low and slow, they can withstand that a lot longer, and they can lose 50% before it happens. We look at the metabolic requirements of the child or the client. An active person has more signs and symptoms because they actually have more demand for oxygen. Sedentary person has less or less signs and symptoms because there's less demand. So again, their activity level or their metabolic requirements can play a part. And then we also look at any concurrent disorders or disabilities that a patient might have, because they're more likely to have more severe problems. Aplastic anemia, it's just a deficiency, and you've got this all written out, deficiency of the blood cells that results from failure of the bone marrow to produce adequate numbers of circulating blood cells, can be congenital or acquired. When it's congenital, again, it's referred to as Fanconi's anemia. Acquired, they get aplastic anemia from drugs or chemicals, most likely with radiation, viruses, immune disorders. Less often when we discontinue exposure kind of immediately. And then the treatment is, of course, based on the symptoms or the symptomatology that they're having. Good old diagnostic tests. Yeah, you've heard about these before. These are ranges, hemoglobin for the male, 13.5 to 17.5, female, 11.5 to 15.5. I know your book has a whole little table about babies and whole little stages and whatever and what their different levels are. We're going to speak in the much more general in regards to this. I'm not going to make you remember what baby's hemoglobin is supposed to be, et cetera, by age. Hematocrit is usually 3 times the hemoglobin. Males, again, we're looking. Did you have a question? Oh, you're stretching. Okay. Males, 40 to 52%. Females, 36 to 48%. The reticulocyte count gives us the bone marrow response. And when they're anemic, that retic count is going to rise. So if they're anemic, we're going to see their reticulocyte count rise. RBC indices, MCV, MCHC, RDW, these tell us as far as the anemia goes if it's microcytic, so if our red blood cells are small, or if it's macrocytic, a macrocytic anemia where we have larger cells. We can do serum vitamin B12 and folate levels. And again, these are cofactors that are required for making red blood cells. So if they're deficient in one, they're going to have an issue perhaps making red blood cells. We can do iron studies, serum iron, total iron binding capacity, how much iron is in that blood, and whether that iron in the blood is binding, is able to go and do what it's supposed to do, or if it's not, so that they're not getting done what they need to get done. Anemia pharmacology, and you've got that as well, erythropoietin, all these things like Epogen and Procrit, these drugs can be used to increase the production of red blood cells. And it's just the procedure in which the body produces red blood cells. It is stimulated by decreased oxygen in circulation, which the kidneys detect that there's a decreased oxygen circulating, and then they're going to secrete erythropoietin, and then that's going to help stimulate proliferation and differentiation, which is going to lead to red blood cell production. It's a whole big deal. Vitamin B12 converts folic acid from its inactive form to its active form. All cells rely on folic acid. Folic acid is needed for production of new red blood cells. Water-soluble B-complex vitamin, they can give it PO or IV, and a higher dose is going to turn that urine dark yellow. Think about the process and what's going on in the body. And then they'll receive a blood transfusion if they have significant anemia. And usually once they receive a blood transfusion, we're going to have improvement in their signs and in their symptoms as far as what's going on. But it's not something that they just jump on and do necessarily right away. When we talk about iron or iron supplements, there are a bunch of different ones, Feosol, ferrous fumarate, ferrous gluconate. We know iron is best absorbed on an empty stomach, so that is advised to take it an hour before meals. We know something acidic like orange juice is going to increase absorption of that. Um, We know we don't take iron with milk or antacids because that, again, is going to decrease the absorption. What other citrus foods or citrus things can you use that will help increase absorption besides orange juice? Not everybody likes orange juice. Strawberries? Think about strawberries? Citrus fruits? Oranges, lemons, limes.
Can they take lemonade?
Lemonade might well do it, yeah, depending upon if you're using real lemons and, yeah, that good old homemade lemonade. Not the Crystal Light necessarily, which is, well, it still has citric acid in it, so anyway. We have to think about the side effects or the GI side effects, and there are a lot, and people won't take or won't want to take iron because it can cause constipation, can cause cramping, can cause nausea and vomiting. So we need to think about that. So one thing we might have them do is to take a stool softener. They might need to start their iron supplementation low and then kind of gradually build up as the body builds up tolerance a little bit. What about high fiber and fluids? Increase fluids, increase high fiber in their diet. All those things can work to help with the GI side effects like the constipation, which can be big, it can be major, and people are not going to take it as a result. So we don't like to think about it, but again, it can happen. It'll turn the stool green or black, and iron can also stain the teeth. Long term, they're giving it 6 to 12 months to replenish the body stores. If they have to have IM iron, then it is given Z-Track. It does cause local pain in the area, but more importantly, I guess, is that it can stain the skin. So if we're not administering it correctly, they can have something on them that is where the skin got stained. If it can stain the teeth, it can stain the skin. So if it's a liquid iron preparation, they need to drink it with or use a straw. Rinse their mouth after, the whole nine yards, because it can stain teeth. IV iron, it is something they do. It's not, it does say it's rare, but IV iron is a whole nother kettle of fish. I mean, as far as having to give iron IV. I mean, I had to have it, and it's a whole big deal, and how it makes you feel, and anyway, not that that's necessarily important, but it's something we rarely do with our kids. We'll probably go to IM iron before we would go to IV iron. And again, look at the ones that are most often involved are adolescents, and if you have an adolescent female that's iron deficient and she's feeling really cruddy as a result, and you tell her she's going to have to take iron, and then all of a sudden, the iron tablets that she's taking are making her constipated or nauseous or whatever. So you have to think about that as well. So again, I know back in the day when they had Flintstones chewable vitamins, the chewable vitamins, you could get Flintstones with iron as well. You don't want to overdose a child on iron either. But, you know, sometimes you have to do that just because iron's not really something fun you have to do. But you don't want to get it to that point. Medical management, of course, this makes sense. Correct the cause. So we're going to give them back what's missing. We're going to control the cause. So if they're having this because of or as a result of bleeding, then we're going to do something about it to stop the bleeding. They might have to have surgery, depending upon where and what is bleeding. So we're going to have to do something about that. And then we're also going to replace lost or destroyed red blood cells, and that is usually through a blood transfusion. So we're going to give them back what's missing. Now this is kind of tiny, I know, on the slide, but, and you've got it all written out here, think about your nursing assessment. And we're talking about anemia in particular. Anemia is our great big overlying deal, and we're having anemia as a result of any number of causes or reasons. So it's very important we do a history. We're going to talk to them. What kind of symptoms have they been having? What kind of symptoms would you expect them to have if they are anemic and they're having this issue? How about fatigue? If my blood is carrying a decreased amount of iron, then I'm going to be fatigued. I'm going to have some fatigue. I'm going to probably be irritable. And if you haven't picked up on it yet, just about any condition we talk about with our kids or in pediatrics, one of the big things that it always causes is irritability. So we have to think about that irritability. Dyspnea on exertion. They start playing, and then all of a sudden they have trouble catching their breath. They're short of breath. They might become real sensitive to cold. It's another sign. They might even have numbness and tingling in their extremities. We're going to get our objective data. We're going to do a medical history. What meds are they on? Are they using alcohol? What about family history? What about their activity? What about nutrition? Again, think about those foods that contain iron and how much we're going to find in our fast food preparations. Do you think those foods contain a lot of iron? Well, I don't. I'm not faulting that. That's, you know, some people's lifestyle, and that's what some people do. And then, of course, you have your toddlers and your little people that aren't going to do that. My girls went through, or my youngest went through the white face with her eating of food as far as when she was a toddler. So it was like, macaroni and cheese. So she ate white foods, macaroni and cheese, a cheese sandwich. So she was very limited in what she would eat. And toddlers are like that, you know, they're grab and go and they're gonna pick up and grab something. That doesn't mean they're going to necessarily pick up something that contains iron when they do that. And then raisins are a good source of iron, but we don't want to give raisins to our kids under 3 because of the choking hazard. So you kind of balance everything out and think about it. We're going to do a physical exam. So we'll just go down the systems. We'll do general weakness, fatigue, malaise. We'll do HAEMT. Mucous membranes, we're going to expect them to be dry and pale. Tongue is going to be smooth, red, it might be beefy looking. That's a B12 issue. Glossitis, angular keloids. Have you ever heard of what angular keloids is? When you develop these little ulcers in the corner of your mouth here that hurt. But it's usually angular keloids is those little ulcers. Headache, epistaxis. As far as nosebleeds, gum bleeding. These are all things we might see or find out about when we're doing our physical. Cardio, so when we're doing our cardiac system, tachycardic or tachycardia. Their heart's beating faster because their iron is less, so the body's trying to perfuse because we've got an iron issue as far as that goes, so we're trying to do something about it. So tachycardia, palpitations, dyspnea, DOE, dyspnea on exertion, that can happen too. Dizziness, orthopnea. Oh, I kind of ran that up there, didn't I?
skin.
They might be pale. They might have jaundice. Frequent easy bruising. They might have ankle edema. Brittle nails, ridge nails, concave nails. GI, nausea, vomiting, coffee ground emesis. Melanous stools, you know what that is? Blood in the stools, so they have dark stools, and we need to check them for occult blood. They have those dark tarry stools. They might have dark stools as a result of iron as well, but, or taking in iron. Diarrhea, anorexia. GU, we're going to talk with our females again about their menstrual flow. We have light flows, heavy flows, irregular flows. What's going on with that? Neuro, presence and extent of peripheral numbness or any ataxia, poor coordination, confusion, etc. And then we could do lab tests. We can do for pernicious anemia. We can do the Romberg test. The Romberg test is when they have a loss of balance with their eyes closed. So you have them stand and close their eyes, and then they get real unsteady or lose balance. So that's kind of weird, but it can happen. So what are we going to do about it? Nursing management, manage fatigue. Fatigue is the most common symptom or the most frequent symptom and the most frequent complication of anemia. A lot of times the providers are gonna kinda, or some providers might really diminish this or dismiss this, but it'll have the greatest effect on their daily functioning. If you're fatigued and just don't feel like you can do anything, it can have big ramifications on your daily functioning, what you're able to do. Improve their diet. So we want to maintain adequate nutrition. So as we said, iron deficiency, organ meats, in particular liver, beans, green leafy veggies, raisins, molasses. We said something about taking iron with vitamin C, the same thing with iron-rich foods. So if they're taking iron-rich foods and they're also doing that with vitamin C, that's going to help the body absorb it better. B12 deficiency, then they need foods of animal origin. So if you have a vegan, that might be an issue with your vegan. Yeah, not vegetarian. Vegans are more specific about not doing anything of animal origin, like no butter and all those kinds of things. But anyway, no alcohol. It interferes with utilization of essential nutrients. And again, hopefully with our kiddos, it's not going to be a big issue. Adolescents, don't let them fool you. Because it can happen with our adolescents. Maintain adequate perfusion, transfusions or IV fluids as needed. Promote medication compliance. So let's talk to them about the purpose of the med, how to take it, what side effects they can expect. And a lot of times the side effects we have for medications are the reason or results in the noncompliance. I just can't lecture y'all. It just kills me. And we're going to look for monitoring. We're going to monitor and manage potential complications. We're going to look at cardiac complications. Remember I said about the tachycardia, how the body is trying to compensate. And the heart's trying to compensate because it notes that there's tissue hypoxia. So that heart goes into active mode and it starts pumping a little bit harder. And so we can have issues as a result of that. And then we also mentioned the neuro issues. So we can have neuro issues as a result too. All of those we have to think about. When it comes to evaluation of this, we're going to look at their nutrition. We're going to look at their long-term use of meds, their ADLs. We want to keep them injury-free. We want to review their symptoms. Are they having improvement? Are things getting better? And then we do, of course, our labs. We do an H&H. We want to decrease their symptoms and to get that H&H within normal range. So those are all issues that we can have or that we can see. And that's what we want to do. We want to fix it. It's a problem. Okay. Kind of the meat of the matter. Sickle cell anemia. So, first of all, you have to look at what anemia is. And we said anemia is not enough healthy red blood cells to carry oxygen to the body. So that's just anemia in itself. Sickle cell anemia is a hemoglobinopathy, which is a great big word, in which the normal hemoglobin is replaced with hemoglobin, sickle hemoglobin, or hemoglobin S. So you see on the left in the picture, you see a nice little normal red blood cell. I refer to nice little normal red blood cells as my bumper cars. They're round, so they're flowing through the bloodstream, and hopefully they're going to flow through the bloodstream. They hit another one, they bounce off, they hit another one, they bounce off, but they continue their flow. When we have sickle hemoglobin that's along in that mix, we've got little points almost on each end. So our sickle hemoglobin can flow through the bloodstream, but now I've got, in essence, a little hook on the end. So I'm flowing through the bloodstream and it's like, wait, I bump into somebody, oh, I catch a hold of it, then something else comes along and it catches a hold. And before you know it, you've got a little problem. As you can see, the sickled red blood cell or the sickle hemoglobin is crescent-shaped. It's a crescent-shaped RBC. They die prematurely. And they lead to chronic red blood cell deficiency because this is not near as effective as this nice little round bumper car. This is not going to do it, and things are going to break down a lot quicker. Oh, I went ahead. And you've got other information there, most commonly found in African American, 1 in 375. Hispanics are number 2 with sickle cell anemia. It's an autosomal recessive. Apparently I'm talking too loud. Better? No. That was Miss Akins over here pulling her mask down and whispering things at me. I always know when she's lecturing because she always comes in here and tells me I'm too loud. But anyway, so sickle cell is autosomal recessive. I know you had sickle cell in pathophysiology, right? Uh-huh. Heads nod. So you know both parents must be carriers in order to pass the gene down to their children. There's a 25% chance that one of their children will have or contract the disease. Of 4 children, 2 will be carriers, 1 will be unaffected, and 1 will have the disease. So, kind of a rough breakdown when you think about it. Or can be.
So again, when we look at pathophysiology, clinical manifestations are a result. So what we see clinically with our kiddos with sickle cell is a result of that obstruction and that increased red blood cell destruction. So we've got obstructions, we've got red blood cell destruction, and that's what we see in our kids that have sickle cell. Sickling leads to blockage of the microcirculation. So when we're looking at obstruction, let me go back. When we're looking at obstruction and red blood cell destruction, that's apparent in the spleen and in the liver, heart, and kidneys, and this over time will cause damage, long-term damage of the organs. So over time, all this obstruction, red blood cell destruction, all of this is going to play a part or have a toll on the body over time. Sickling leads to blockage of the microcirculation, hemolysis, and anemia. And they're going to show those signs of anemia. They're going to have shortness of breath. They might be dizzy, might have a headache, pale skin, chest pain, and fatigue. All can be signs of these things going on. Decreased or absent blood flow leads to local hypoxia, tissue ischemia, and infarction, which is tissue death caused by a lack of oxygen, again, to that tissue or in that system. The sickling effect on organs is going to result in stasis of blood with enlargement, infarction with ischemia, and repeated destruction and replacement with scar tissue. So none of these are good. I wouldn't want any of these, but this is what our kiddos with sickle cell deal with. This is what they have. This is what they deal with. So when we look at diagnostic evaluation for sickle cell, newborn screening is done in all states. Let's get out ahead of this if we've got a problem. Let's screen our newborns, and if we find we've got this, let's get out ahead of it. Hemoglobin electrophoresis is done to determine the level, like how much sickle hemoglobin or hemoglobin S is in there. So they do hemoglobin electrophoresis. And again, early diagnosis is essential to prevent complications. If it's not diagnosed in infancy, it will most likely manifest as they are in toddlerhood or during preschool years. So of course I say, why? Why do you think that typically happens? Why will it present later? Good guess, but not it. Good guess. That's great. She said more active. That's not really it. Fetal hemoglobin is present after birth, meaning there is less hemoglobin S. So because of the presence of fetal hemoglobin, and that fetal hemoglobin is going to rapidly decrease during that first year of life. So we may not notice it initially. Now they do the studies and the tests, we're not going to have problems initially because they do have fetal hemoglobin. But that's going to go away. So again, clinical manifestations, there's a table in your book, 51.5, page 1446. And then we can look at the general things that are going on. Generally, we'll have growth retardation, chronic anemia, their hemoglobin is between 6 and 9, a delayed sexual maturation, marked susceptibility to sepsis, so they are at an increased risk. The blood is sludgy, like thicker, if you will. If you have massive anemia, you'll see an increased retic count. We already said that retics, if our reticulocyte count is up, reticulocytes are immature red blood cells. And so if we do a retic count, that's going to let us know if our bone marrow is producing enough red blood cells. So kind of what's going on in our bone marrow. Now, clinically, one of the big things we have with sickle cell is sequestration crisis. And what we have with that is blood pools in the liver and in the spleen. And that results in hepatosplenomegaly, which is an enlarged liver and spleen. This will cause decreased blood volume. We'll have a drop in the blood pressure, and they can even have shock symptoms as a result of sequestration crisis. It can result in death from anemia and cardiovascular collapse. And with sequestration crisis, you can actually feel the enlarged organs. A lot of times the doctor, I know at Ochsner LSU, Dr. Giroudi does a lot with the sickle cell kids. And he'd even let you feel. It's like, here, you feel this. And he lets you come behind and feel. But they are markedly enlarged. So we have a problem as a result. They can have aplastic crisis, decreased production and increased destruction. So the body's not producing enough and the body is also destroying red blood cells, resulting in profound anemia. Bone marrow infarct, where the bone marrow can't make red blood cells. And this can be triggered by viral infection or depletion of folic acid. And we're going to talk about meds in a little bit, because meds are really kind of important with these kiddos too. We can have a hyperhemolytic crisis, accelerated rate of red blood cell destruction, characterized by anemia, jaundice, and reticulocytosis, or an increase in reticulocytes. Again, those immature red blood cells. All because we're destroying red blood cells. Bottom line. Our vaso-occlusive crisis results from sickled cells obstructing blood vessels, and that equals pain in the area of involvement. A lot of times when you have sickle cell kids come in, they're having a vaso-occlusive crisis, and they come in with pain. The last one we saw in the clinic was having pain in their tailbone. That was not one I was familiar with. A lot of times it might be the arms, it might be the legs, but maybe his was back and he just thought it was down low enough that it was his tailbone. Not exactly sure. Yes, ma'am.
Is that what they call a pain crisis?
Yes. A vaso-occlusive crisis and a pain crisis would probably be the same thing. Because that's what it causes. It causes pain. So we're going to have distal ischemia and pain. Why is it distal? What's different about distal? Smaller blood vessels. Very good. So it is smaller. They have smaller blood vessels. When we're doing assessment, we'll see slow cap refill. Cool, pale extremities, decreased sensation, and they might even have ulceration due to tissue ischemia, because that tissue's not getting
the oxygen it needs. You can have something called hand and foot syndrome. Again, occlusion in the small distal bones of the hands and the feet, resulting in pain and swelling. You can have it in the abdomen, in the belly, where they have surgical pain. It kind of looks like an acute surgical condition, like you need to take them to surgery because they've got like an acute abdomen. But it's that pain that kind of is mimicking that, or it's occurring there. You can have it in the brain, of course. They can have a stroke. It's very sad to see, I don't remember how old this child was. She was 6 or 7, and she had had a stroke because she had that occur there, the vaso-occlusive crisis in the cerebrum. You can have visual disturbances as a result. You can have it in the chest. Acute chest is something we kind of get worried about. Acute chest resembles pneumonia. They have chest pain, shortness of breath, and cough, usually with that. They can have arthralgias, like pain in the joints. They can have priapism. You know what it is? Okay, I get some head nods. Painful erection due to blockage and blood pooling. They can have it in the kidney, and they would have hematuria as a result. So management, and this is something else, courtesy of Dr. Weston, what your handout was as well. Hop to it. We added an H. Heat, because heat is beneficial, dilates, lets blood flow. Hydration, beneficial. Oxygenation and pain management. So that's your HH, no, hop to it, if you want to say. This is in no particular order. So we don't think, okay, first I do with heat, then I do hydrate. No, it's in no particular order. It's based on your patient's needs. So we make that basis or that determination on that. So what we want to do is prevent. We want to prevent disease. We want to prevent crisis. How would we prevent disease in the first place? Genetic counseling? Yeah? Do the parents know? Are you do you have the trait or you don't have the trait? So if we get two parents with the trait, then we're increasing the likelihood of that child having it. We want to prevent crisis. We can do that by hydration. We can do that by making sure we're keeping things flowing like they should. Adequate hydration is essential, and we want to avoid dehydration. So these kiddos going to school, that would be something you'd need to talk to their teachers about if they were going to school. Because they would need water breaks. They would need the ability to go and get a drink of water. If they're drinking more fluids, what else are they going to need? Potty breaks, right? They need to go. If you've ever been around any, first, second, third graders or whatever, if one wants to go, then guess what? Everybody wants to go. So you need to make sure that the teacher knows there's an issue or a reason for this, not that, you just went 30 minutes ago, you don't need to go. So we need to make sure our teachers are informed as well. We want to maintain their oxygenation, which sounds kind of weird, but we want to make sure we do that. We want to provide prophylactic antibiotics. Infection can be a big bad thing. If we've got sludgy blood, then we're going to have a problem. So we're going to put them on prophylactic antibiotics. It's not abnormal at all to see
Sickle cell kids taking penicillin daily. Not abnormal. Okay? We're going to treat medical emergencies. Again, we have to think about that. We say heat. So what if a child with sickle cell sprains their ankle? Are we going to do rest, ice, compression, elevation? Are we going to do that? Are we going to put ice on a child with sickle cell? No. What's it going to do? It's going to dilate. No, constrict. Get it right. It's going to constrict those vessels. If we constrict those vessels, we're going to lead to a crisis by doing that. So we have to think a little bit differently, right? But we're going to treat any medical emergencies that they have. We want them to get their vaccines. Dun, 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 dun. Vaccines are important, and we want to make sure we're controlling pain. Go back to the whole thing of pain is what they say it is, where they say it is, whatever. You can't be judgmental if you have a teen with sickle cell and they say their pain level is at an 8 and they're laying there very calmly in the bed. They're probably used to having a pain at a level of 8 and they're not in there because they want medications. I'm just telling you. Or it's a very rare thing indeed if they are. But I don't tend to go that way in my thinking. If they say they're hurting, then they're hurting. Okay, she gave you the hydration formula as well in those notes. It keeps rearing its ugly head. I know. It doesn't go away. And it's not going away now. I'm not going back through it. Just a reminder. And this is maintenance hydration, y'all. This is maintenance. So think about it. Okay. Acute chest. Presence of pulmonary infiltrate. Acute chest syndrome is a medical emergency. It's one of the most common reasons for hospitalization, and it's a common cause of death for patients with sickle cell disease. We're not playing. Clinically, they'll have chest pain, back pain, belly pain, fever, 101.3 or higher, congested cough, dyspnea, tachypnea, retractions, and declining O2 sats. So things are getting serious, or things already are serious. So what are we going to do to treat this? How about deep breathing? How about antibiotics? How about oxygen? How about pain meds? Maybe a blood transfusion. They might even have to have a chest tube. All from acute chest. Another one is CVA. Sudden severe complication can occur in the absence of related illness. Major blood vessels of the brain are blocked, leading to cerebral infarction. And that can cause variable degrees of neurological impairment. Current treatment involves chronic transfusion therapy. So at first they'll do an exchange transfusion. So basically they're going to pull off some of that patient's blood and replace it. Exchange. We're swapping it out. So hopefully we're pulling off more of that sickled hemoglobin and replacing it with normal red blood cells. And they're gonna, then they would do chronic transfusions, trying to get the hemoglobin S less than 30%. Clinically, you'd probably see a lot of the same things you'd see with anybody having a CVA. Severe headache, vomiting, jerking of the face, legs, arms, seizures, strange behavior, inability to move their arm or leg, slurred speech, weakness in the hands and feet, and vision changes. None of which is any good. So therapeutically, therapeutic management, we want to prevent sickling and we want to treat any medical emergencies due to crisis that these children might have. Crisis management is generally supportive and symptomatic. So we want to minimize triggers. Fever, hypoxia, emotional or physical stress. Sometimes we'd have kids with sickle cell that would come in right after the new school year started or whatever. And that was usually, it was probably more of an emotional stress to them than anything, because maybe they were going from middle school to high school, or maybe they were going from elementary school to middle school, and the things that they might have encountered doing that and caused them stress as far as emotional stress. Rest to minimize oxygen use. We can put them on short-term O2 therapy. Treat hypoxia quickly to reduce the sickling effect. Oxygen may prevent further sickling, but it's not useful in reversing the sickling because it can't get to the clumps of sickle red blood cells in the clogged vessels. Prolonged use, again, can cause bone marrow suppression, leading to decreased production of red blood cells. So again, we put them on short-term R2 therapy, kind of get them through, and to prevent further sickling. But it's not going to reverse something that's already happened, and long-term, it can have other effects. Oral and IV hydration. They can resume, sickled cells can resume their normal shape if they're rehydrated and reoxygenated. Again, that's why hydration is so very important. Again, the membrane, they can resume normal shape. The membrane is still fragile, and the cell life is shortened to 15 days instead of 120 days as is normal. Fluid also helps reduce the viscosity of the blood. Remember we said sludge, blood gets kind of sludgy. So if we increase fluid, that's going to help with that viscosity of the blood. Electrolyte replacement to combat metal effects that result from hypoxia. So again, we're going to give them electrolyte back to kind of help that out a little bit. Pain management. So we typically use, for pain management, we use PCAs. PCAs are great, patient-controlled analgesia. A lot of times they're given a baseline rate and then they can still hit their button periodically. So we're not going to give them too much, or they're not going to get too much. So PCAs are great. Typically they're going to use Dilaudid or morphine in the PCA. Dilaudid or morphine in the PCA. We don't use Demerol because of the
meperidine effects. The Demerol breaks down, and you can have norepinephrine effects from the Demerol. So typically we use Dilaudid or morphine in our PCAs. We're gonna use blood replacement to treat the anemia. We're gonna have them on antibiotics. Prophylactic antibiotics to prevent pneumococcal infection. Remember, their spleen does not work. So their spleen's not able to do what it's supposed to do. So we're going to have them on antibiotics. Pneumococcal, flu, and meningococcal vaccines are recommended, again, because they have an increased susceptibility to infection. So we want them to receive all of those. Exchange transfusions to reduce the number of circulating sickle cells. And some kiddos came in periodically. They'd come into the hospital periodically to have an exchange transfusion done. And then they'd be discharged the next day. So just depending upon their needs. Splenectomy requires prophylactic penicillin. A lot of times our kids, like three-year-olds and whatever, with this, and if they have sequestration crisis with a severely enlarged spleen, a lot of times they'll go in and pull the spleen and just get rid of that. And then they're going to need to stay on prophylactic penicillin. They're going to have that post-op, and then they'll probably continue. Packed red blood cells for splenic sequestration. Again, we're trying to get their hemoglobin to 9 or 10. We don't want it to be too high, because as the crisis resolves, then again, red blood cells are released and you can get a rebound effect. So we can have too much. And if you have too many RBCs, then you're going to have another issue with clotting. So... The sickled hemoglobin.
The sickled hemoglobin.
Right, that was sickled hemoglobin.
So we're replacing it with good.
Right. If we give them, red blood cells, then we're doing that, just that. Exchange transfusions, we're pulling off some of their blood and replacing it with red blood cells, packed red blood cells. So we're exchanging. We're pulling off the bad and increasing the good, because they have a very high level of the sickled hemoglobin in their blood. Pain management to include analgesia, fluid management, complementary therapy, physical therapy, again, opioids, usually with a PCA, and that's what's used for severe pain. If they have a milder pain, we can give them ibuprofen, or we can give them codeine, or we can give them Lortab for more moderate pain. A lot of the doctors are very weird about using Tylenol and ibuprofen because it can mask fever. So if they put them on that, then they won't know if that child has a fever. It can mask those symptoms. So they have their own peculiarities when they're dealing with it. Common sickle cell meds, folic acid. We've talked about folic acid, what it does. The red blood cells die too quickly. We deplete their levels. It's really funny. A lot of kids with sickle cell can take their folic acid in nothing. You bring them the tablet, a lot of them will just chew it up and swallow it. Not saying it's a chewable tablet. They'll chew it up and they'll swallow it. It's very routine to them as far as folic acid. Hydroxyurea, it promotes the body production of the fetal hemoglobin, which is shown to prevent sickling of red blood cells. It can decrease incidence of vaso-occlusive episodes, an acute chest, prolongs life expectancy. Overall, hydroxyurea works very, very well, or they found that it works very, very well. On the flip, hydroxyurea is a chemo drug, which is kind of weird because it's in a capsule, but for a while there, we weren't even allowed to give it to the patient because we weren't chemo certified. So we went from a span we could give it to the patients because it's just a capsule. Again, same precautions, you don't touch them. You wear gloves, the whole thing, because it is a chemo agent. We'd give them to the patients, no problem. Then it came out with, we had the alert on the computer when you go to give them, you must be chemo certified to give them. Last I heard, I think the nurses that were not chemo certified were again allowed to give them. So it's kind of a cyclical thing, but hydroxyurea is a chemo drug. Antibiotics, babies born with this are at a high risk for developing infections that can become life-threatening within hours, particularly bacterial pneumonia. For this reason, children are given oral penicillin starting at age 2 until they're at least 5 years of age. A lot of times, if the physician thinks they're at a high risk for developing pneumonia, he will keep them on it. Or if they've had splenectomy because of repeated sequestration crisis and they went ahead and pulled the spleen, then they will also keep them on penicillin as a prophylactic measure. Prognosis, it's a chronic illness with a terminal outcome. The heart works too hard, cardiomegaly, murmurs are possible. Not to mention there are just many long-term effects of chronic vaso-occlusion. The vessels occlude, then they're clear, and they occlude. So there are long-term effects of that as well. Lungs, decreased pulmonary function, they're susceptible to infections, they have pulmonary insufficiency. Kidneys, you can see all the systems that can be affected. Most live to their 50s and can participate in normal activities. Some may have developmental delays that can cause problems as they're an adolescent or in adolescence. So you have a lot of different issues and a lot of things that can happen as a result of sickle cell anemia. Well, it's just anemia. No, it's very profound. And it can have major complications. Hematopoietic stem cell transplantation is the only known cure. They must have severe complications related to the disease, and they must have a family donor who is genotypically identical. So they do have something they can do about it, but again, and it's also very important, and I didn't say this earlier, that they know what triggers an event. We were just talking informally and clinical, but you think about like a change in altitude, where you might have an issue with that as far as going to the mountains or doing something different, because that can have a difference and can cause a problem in some instances. So we have to think about that. So nursing management, educate children and families on the disease and its consequences. Educate them on early intervention for problems. So these triggers, what is it? Cigarette smoking can be a trigger, high altitudes, unpressurized air travel, excessive temps, dehydration, infection, stress, excessive or strenuous exercise, things they need to be taught to avoid. Educate them again on penicillin prophylaxis.
And we just talked about the length of time on that. Teach parents to monitor for splenic sequestration and respiratory problems. That means we need to get something done, and we need to get something done pretty quickly. Treat the child normally. They can go to school. They can participate in normal activities. They can be active. They can play sports. And that fluid is essential with any of these things. They need to have that hydration on board, and we need to be very cognizant and aware of that. But again, treat them normally. If we don't, and we'll talk about this in particular with hemophilia, if we're not treating them normally, like anybody else, if we're wrapping, parents are wrapping them in cotton wool, we're not disciplining them, or we're not doing anything in regards to what their needs might be, then we're going to really mess with their stages of development. They're not going to be able to achieve some of those developmental stages if we're protecting them so tightly all the time. Which sounds crazy, but that's important with a growing child as well. So we want to do these things. Treat them normally. Let's see. Emphasize the need for adequate hydration. We've gone through that a lot. Emphasize the need for adequate nutrition. They need 20% more calories to fuel the production of red blood cells to replace the damaged ones. And we need to make sure we increase iron in the diet. So all of these things are important. Pain management. Assess pain using old carts. Have you ever heard of old carts? Let me see if I can remember everything now. Location, duration.
Just checking.
Yeah, everything's good.
Right.
Kind of freaked me out. I heard the door open and close, and I've already been told I was too loud and had to cut my volume down. So
I can't hear that. Okay, so the flavor was just trying to do it. So when I was taking a break, it starts back up in 5.
Okay. So acknowledge the pain is real. We already said that. Act on their complaints of pain. Old carts is a mnemonic, and you can look it up and see what all it stands out. Location, duration. I'm trying to remember what occurrence, location, duration.
Characteristics.
Yeah, characterize. How would you characterize it? Sharp, stabbing, whatever.
Is it the same as cold spot? It's the same.
Yeah. What one do you use?
Cold spa. We were taught
cold spa. Cold spa. Well, that's even better. Okay. Psychological support to deal with depression and anxiety and fear. And you can see how all those things can occur. Active listening, positive reinforcement. PCA encourages their involvement when they're hospitalized in pain. They gives them a little bit more control over that. Bed rest is only effective if the pain is controlled and the schedule is organized. Apply heat to the affected area, not cold. We already said that. Monitor blood transfusions and reactions. You know that. You've heard that. So if I give you a question about giving a blood transfusion, you're going to remember that up, right? Yeah. You better? Yep. Be aware of an increase in the spleen size. And again, as I said, you can feel it. It's palpable. Monitor vital signs and blood pressure for impending shock. Monitor for signs of anemia, signs of obstruction and destruction. O2 if hypoxemia is present, and for comfort. Strict INO, daily weights, labs,
else. We're increasing hydration. Diuresis can occur. If they start to diuresis, it can mess with our electrolytes. So make sure we're aware of all that good stuff. And this is predominantly when you have these kiddos in hospital. Of course, treating them like normal, that's something parents need to do at home, and they need to be doing some of these other things. But when you have a child with sickle cell that's hospitalized, it's very important that you do these things as well. Next one on our little hit parade, immune thrombocytopenia purpura, ITP, page 1812. So you know what thrombocytopenia is, low platelets, a reduction in destruction of platelets despite normal platelet production in the bone marrow. Something's going on and we don't know. And a lot of times with immune thrombocytopenia purpura, we don't know why their body's going through this, why their body's doing this. A lot of times it'll develop 1 to 3 weeks after a viral infection, again, such as chickenpox or rubella. Another reason to vaccinate your children. What's a normal platelet level? How many platelets should you normally have? 150,000 to 400? Yeah, like she said. Clinical manifestations. Multiple ecchymosis. We know what ecchymosis is. Basically a bruise. Discoloration of the skin because they're bleeding underneath it. Purpuric rash. Purpura is a purplish discoloration of the skin produced by small bleeding vessels near the surface. So they have purpura. Sorry. Petechiae. Again, it's bleeding into the skin. Petechiae are usually smaller. Bleeding from the mucous membranes and gums. And prolonged bleeding from an abrasion in a child in otherwise good health. Child's playing, they scrape their leg, and it just won't stop bleeding. Or it might not stop bleeding. That's a little picture, petechiae with thrombocytopenic purpura. So you've got all these little areas where there's bleeding that's been occurring underneath the skin. Okay. So the goal with ITP is to prevent life-threatening bleeding events. Most cases of ITP are self-limiting. So we would use rest and prednisone, IVIG. They may also need a splenectomy. Weird as that sounds. So our body normally makes enough antibodies to fight germs, but when you have an immune deficiency like this, your body can't make enough of them. So IVIG gives you antibodies that your body is not making so your body can fight. Did you need something? Okay. Today's our day for visitors. So again, we think about that. Nursing consideration. They may need an IV, so IV access may be necessary. Because they have low platelets, puncture can cause bruising. So when you puncture the skin, you puncture the vessel to do
to start your IV and everything. A lot of times, because they have low platelets anyway, and you're going to see bruising, you might think you've blown the vein, and that's not necessarily the case. It's just because they have ITP. So think about that, you know. Teaching is always very important. Home care, we're going to restrict activity. We want to pad any corners in the room so they're not going to bump into something like a corner of the cabinet or countertop or whatever. With a baby or a child, well, more like a baby or toddler in a crib, we want to pad those crib rails. We might want to put extra joint padding on their clothes, like on their knees or whatever, so when they're trying to walk or they're walking and they fall down, that we have a little bit of extra padding that's going to help prevent bleeding or bleeding under the skin. Avoid meds that affect platelet function. You remember those are aspirin and ibuprofen. We might need to use, and we probably do need to use, an extra soft toothbrush. And usually that's with platelets less than 20,000, but it's not going to hurt anyway. So we want to make sure we use an extra soft toothbrush for these kiddos. I jumped ahead. So that's ITP, or immune thrombocytopenia purpura, hard to say. Next we have hemophilia. Guys, we're almost done. Okay. Hemophilia. We've heard of hemophilia. It's a deficiency of factor 8, 9, or 11. So they have, because of this factor deficiency, they have an impaired ability to control bleeding because they lack factor. This is produced by the liver. Factor is produced by the liver. It's necessary for formation of thromboplastin. The less factor present, the more severe the disease. So what are these kiddos going to look like? If a child has hemophilia, what are we going to see? Easy bruising and hematomas, yeah? Active bleeding, they might have epistaxis. They might have nosebleeds. They might have bleeding gums. They might have tarry stools. They can have headaches. We've got bleeding going on, y'all. Slurred speech. Decreased level of consciousness, in particular with a brain bleed. Hemarthrosis, joint pain and stiffness when they actually bleed into the joint, and that causes painful joints and it causes stiffness in the joint because blood fills that joint capsule. There are different classifications of hemophilia. So if you have severe hemophilia, you can bleed or have spontaneous bleeding without even trauma. If you have moderate hemophilia, you usually have bleeding with trauma. So you bumped into something, you fell down, you did something, and that's going to result in bleeding. If you have mild hemophilia, you'll have bleeding with severe trauma or with surgery. We diagnose this with lab tests, a prolonged PTT, and other specific tests determine which factor it is that is missing. So they have a prolonged PTT because blood takes longer to clot. So their PTT would be prolonged. This is just a picture of hemarthrosis and joint destruction. So on your left is a normal knee. In the middle, you have bleeding into the joint.
And on the far right, you have a joint capsule and it's swollen because it's filled with blood. So that's what's going on with these kiddos with sickle cell. Not sickle cell, with hemophilia. I'm sorry, guys. So what do we do? What's our nursing management for hemophilia? Apply pressure to insertion sites after needle withdrawal. How long would you apply pressure? 5 minutes. At least 5 minutes. If I'm discontinuing an IV, I'm going to hold pressure for at least 5 minutes. Avoid injections, venipuncture, invasive procedures. What about rectal temps? No. You better not. Monitor for bleeding. Might be wounds, it might be stool, might be urine. Pain relief, we're gonna do ice to the joints. Sickle cell, we do heat. Hemophilia, we do ice. We wanna constrict with hemophilia, we wanna dilate with sickle cell. So there's a difference. So we think about education, which is crucial. Safety and play. Again, parents can't take their child and keep them in a playpen all day long because we're gonna cause other effects by doing that. As much as they want to, they can't wrap them up in cotton, like put them in a one of those little balls, you know, that you go inside and you can walk and you can do all this stuff in those little ball things to play with. Well, anyway, you can't wrap them up. You can't put them in cotton wool. You can't prevent things from happening as much as you might want to. But you want to make sure you've got safety in play so that as they're playing that they don't have sharp things to play with. Well, no kid should, but anyway. So just kind of encourage and be aware of that. Diet, we want a well-balanced diet. We want to avoid constipation. Why is constipation an issue? If they strain, they might bleed. If they get constipated and they strain, they might bleed. So constipation's big. Soft toothbrush, that kind of goes without saying. Regular exercise, maintain normal weight. A lot of times we don't think about that, but normal weight, and you have less stress and strain on the joints. No rectal temps, we've already said that. Ice to the affected area, we've already said that. Home administration of replacement factors. So parents learn how, and they do, and they're able to do factor replacement at home. Genetic counseling. Again, something they need. Treatment, DDAVP, which is synthetic vasopressin, is effective for mild factor VIII deficiency. So that's something we can use DDAVP. We can do factor VIII replacement. We can give them corticosteroids and nonsteroidals, again, to reduce swelling in those joints. All being careful while we do it. Von Willebrand. Oh, I think this is the last one. Yay!
I have a
question. Sure.
Did you say two give non-steroidal or not two?
Two give or not to give what?
Non-steroidals.
You can use non-steroidals. Corticosteroids and NSAIDs to help reduce swelling and joints. I wouldn't give them Tylenol. Doesn't Tylenol mess with the platelets? What does it mess with? One of them does.
NSAIDs.
All NSAIDs? Corticosteroids and NSAIDs to reduce swelling and take care of the joints. Go with it. If you find something different, let me know. I'll go back and look at it again, too. So von Willebrand's is the most commonly inherited bleeding disorder that affects both males and females. They have either an underproduction or dysfunction of von Willebrand's protein. And von Willebrand's protein is the carrier protein for factor VIII. One of its most important functions is to bind and attract platelets to the site of tissue injury, thus facilitating formation of a clot. Management depends on the severity, just again like hemophilia. Includes history of epistaxis, bleeding from the gums, prolonged bleeding from cuts, excessive bleeding after surgery or trauma, and menorrhagia. Treatment of choice for von Willebrand's type 1 and 2A is DDAVP, and it's given IV or intranasally. So again, you'd have to think about using an intranasal medication if your child has a stuffy nose and can't get any air in their nose, so they wouldn't be able to get the medication in either. One of those dumb little things I mentioned. Interventions, education, medical alert tag. Avoid over-the-counter meds that affect platelets. So yeah, that is our non-steroidals and aspirin. So I would not give a hemophiliac non-steroidals. I'd give them steroids. I could give them steroids, but I wouldn't give them non-steroidals. Correct. Activity limitation depends on severity. So we might not want kids with von Willebrand's participating in contact sports, which kind of makes sense. Okay. I will stop the recording. Anybody have any questions? Pardon?
So we said do not use
the non-steroids? Don't use not NSAIDs.
Okay.
Don't use NSAIDs with hemophilia. Okay? Because again, they can affect clotting and cause a problem that way. So don't do that. All righty.